Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And just to kind of apprise you, we covered the 12th Amendment, and we got Paul Venable back with us from the Constitution Party from Missouri, Mr. Extraordinaire himself. Paul, welcome back, and I guess it goes without saying, you didn't have to check whether you're on mute or not. So good, great.
Right.
And so, folks, it's never easy flying when you're trying to do, you know, recordings and so forth, but and connecting with people. But anyway, I mean, it's a miracle that we make these things work. Okay, right. So we read the 12th Amendment in the last episode. And I know that people can kind of bookend this. And we actually started going through this without going through Article 2. And so it might, you know, it might be good, folks, so that we don't have to reread Article 2. But I do think it's important that we kind of break this up when we read the 12th Amendment so that we identify, okay, here's a, you know, one set of, here's a clause that identifies something that's got to be done, and here's the next thing that has to be done. And if that doesn't work, then here's the next thing that has to be done. And then if that doesn't work, the next thing. Right. That way, by segmenting it, I think most people, because, you know, they didn't use outlines back then. They didn't organize, you know, framing and so forth. They just started at the top of a piece of paper and started writing instructions.
Right.
In, you know, paragraph form. And so let's go ahead and we'll kind of meander through or, you know, kind of do our best at identifying where they go through the, you know, the process. So go ahead and start off, and I'll interrupt you if I think that, because I think the semicolon is where they, you know, that's one thing they have to do. So they usually separate things with semicolons. So we see the first semicolon at the end of the second line. So go ahead.
Right. Here we go. The electors shall meet in their respective states and vote by ballot for president and vice president, one of whom at least shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves.
Okay. So they've just created a parameter that when they vote by ballot, they cannot vote for two people of the same state.
Is that what that means?
Yes. Shall not be. So it says one for president, one for vice president, one of whom at least shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves. Okay. So even before this, now, you got to remember that the 12th Amendment changed Article 2. And right. Article 2, Section 1, you know, I don't want to read the whole thing, but I guess what I need to do is actually go to Article 2, Section 1, and read the very first part that is not included in the 12th Amendment. So, because it's saying that when we look at this, it's saying that we actually have these electors, because it says the electors shall meet in their representative states or their respective states. What happens before this, folks? In other words, how do you get electors? How do you get an elector?
The electors are the process of choosing electors is done by the legislature, right?
No, so this is what it says. Each state shall appoint in such manner, so the state shall appoint, not the state legislature, the state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature may direct a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled in Congress. but no senator, representative, or person holding an office of trust or profit under the United States shall be appointed as an elector. So in other words, you're going to elect an elector, and the state legislature will determine the manner of how those electors will be chosen. Not the outcome. They do not have the authority of the outcome. And you've got to remember, this is a representative government, and this is why we, the people, and it even said this in the ratification debates, the people choose their electors to choose their president. This is a unique system and a unique process. And the Constitution's very clear that the electors shall actually choose and appoint the manner. So remember, we go to the federal elections, and the state legislature over federal elections has to choose the date, time, and place, as well as the manner of the process for choosing the, you know, the federal elections. In other words, for us to choose our representative, right? Because remember, we didn't choose our senator. We only choose our representative. And every 4 years, so every 2 years, we choose a representative. Every 4 years, we would choose what?
A third?
No. The state legislature chooses. Remember, the 17th Amendment hasn't been passed yet.
Right.
Okay.
So the state legislature chooses the senators.
Every 2 years, or every actually, based on the rotation. There'll be one.
You said every 4 years. That threw me. Every 2 years, based on the rotation, a third of the Senate comes up for election.
Well, yeah, correct. So you only have two. So you will have a 2 year gap somewhere in the state legislature. But this isn't about senators. This is about the elections. Remember, the state legislature shall choose the time, place, and manner of how we are to, you know, to vote. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they, in Article 1, have the responsibility. Congress can be involved in that, but Congress cannot be involved in the manner in how the electors are to be chosen. So, in other words, the state is allocated two electors for the Senate and five electors, you know, let's say, for the House of Representatives. Yeah, so, the legislature gets to choose how the people, remember, the ratification debates were clear that the people were to choose their electors. Mm-hmm. The states allocated them. Now, the state legislature gets to determine how. So what could have happened, and probably this is what I think should have been the conundrum of the day, is how does the state legislature deal with the two electors for the Senate? Mm-hmm. Do they choose them for themselves and then give the electors to the people so that they have their own elector? Or they could actually give the two electors to the people and let them vote at large for two electors. In other words, say, okay, these two billets will be at large. Everybody can vote for these two billets. But everybody else will vote for their own elector out of their own congressional district. In other words, you'll vote for your representative and you'll vote for your elector. But you don't do that every 2 years. You only do the voting for your elector once every
4 years.
Every 4 years. And so I want to be really, really clear, because we're only on the first stanza of the 12th mm-hmm. Amendment.
Correct.
So what it basically is saying is that when it says the electors shall meet in their respective states, how did they become electors?
Right. And that's what you mean when you say each state shall appoint. That
yes.
means the people of the state, at following the process defined by the legislature.
Right. So the manner. So the word right there is the manner, not the outcome. So in other words, they get to say, okay, you know, you're going to vote by vocal. You're going to vote by raising of the hand. You're going to vote by ballot. You're going to vote by electronic. The state legislature has the control of the manner of how we vote.
So, you know, what that's, this suggests something else, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is, imagine this. Why should the president's name even show up then on the ballot?
It's not supposed to. We don't elect the president. We do not elect the president. We elect our electors, and it says right here, for the first time, any mention of how, you know, this thing or these candidates who are seeking to become president of the United States are actually chosen.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like it says right here, going back to the stanza, now that we've had our election, and so, folks, let me walk you through like the first 12 elections. The first 12 elections of the president going into the 1830s was done differently for the first few years, where some states actually appointed the electors themselves. They appointed them themselves, which flew in the face of the ratification debates where the people got to choose their electors. I mean, if this is a representative government, then the people, you know, should have the choice of who they're going to have represent them.
Are you saying that some states, some state legislatures selected electors?
Oh, yes, absolutely. New York was one of the first states, of course. That's where the creature lived, and that's where the creature convinced them that they should have that control. And so at the very beginning, there were a couple of states that took latitude in saying, yes. Oh, you know what, we can determine the outcome as well as the manner.
So how come they weren't called out?
Well, because there was that much, I'll just say there was that much play in how this process was. And at that point in time, the states, you know, there were many other things that seemed to be far more important.
It was a new process, too.
And
this has never been done before.
Right? Who was the first president?
Well, it's George Washington.
George Washington. It was a no-brainer, and how they came to that was a no-brainer. So
right.
There wasn't a lot of scrutiny. Had mm-hmm. it been a very contentious election, I honestly would tell you that there would have been a lot of finger-pointing between the mm-hmm. states that chose and the people that chose.
Right.
And so... And how they wanted to interpret it. And I think it would have actually gone back to the state ratification debates at that point in time very quickly. Because mm-hmm. Massachusetts and a couple other states, when they talked about electors, said the people will choose their president via that elector.
Right.
And so
okay.
Going, you know, forward from the very first election where a few states did it, a few more states actually started doing that, but What was interesting was after the first three or four elections, it started migrating towards the people. By the 1820s, it was almost unanimous. Every state in the Union had the people choose their electors, all of them. How okay. they did it, whether they divided the state to say this half gets this, you know, people can run for this ballot and people, the other half of the state can, you know, run for the two for the state. And then each representative or each elector will be chosen via their representative that way. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So... moving on, we get to a point where it's unanimous. By the 1830s, we're solid. There, uh-huh. every state in the Union allows we the people to actually choose the electors in accordance with the Constitution. And in accordance with how the Constitution was sold, that we the people would choose our electors who would then choose our president. So the way the campaigns actually ran, because you do realize that you didn't vote. There was never a point in time when the president's name was on a ballot. And the president mm-hmm. or those who were seeking president, the office of the president, did not campaign as right. far as they didn't travel or because it was just not reasonable. So what happened was there would be people in each of the electors' districts that would throw their hat into the ring and say, choose me to be your elector, and I will vote for George Washington.
Right.
Or sometimes they would campaign on principles and say, I would vote this way. And over time, the parties convinced everybody by the late 1800s that, you know, you just choose who out of the party you want to keep, and then that's how we got into popular elections. Mm-hmm. It was via the party. The party brought us, bestowed upon this republic, a democratic form of government. So now that we know that the people have chosen, you know, they finally standardized it in the early 1800s, that the people chose their electors. In other words, we voted for them, and now what did they do? We finally got to a point where they actually had this commonality, and this is what they did, just like you said. They shall vote by ballot for president and vice president, one of whom shall not be an inhabitant of the same state.
So the same state as. So here was my question. I don't know if you remember this. When Bush Jr. and Cheney ran, they were both in Texas, and Cheney had to move his residence to Wyoming. I don't think this is the same thing. I think, doesn't it mean that it's not the same state as the elector?
Yes.
Okay, because most people think that the president and the vice president should not be from the same state. And I don't think that's correct.
So this is what it says. So you tell me what this means. And shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves.
Themselves refers to the
electors. Absolutely correct. Absolutely. Okay. So how did this get discombobulated? Because people didn't read it, and because somebody set the rule years and years ago, because maybe they didn't like the fact that, you know, two New Yorkers could become president, or two Virginians could become president. So they aggrandized that to say, oh, no, we cannot have a president from the same state and vice president, or president, vice president from the same state. That's a complete misconstruction of what this says.
So let me share something with you really quick. Okay, mm-hmm. I just looked up some information from the Library of Congress. Presidential election of 1812 doesn't even show the popular vote. It was James Madison and DeWitt Clinton. And Madison got 128 votes from the Electoral College, and DeWitt Clinton got 89. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Popular votes, there's a space here for popular vote, but it's blank. Didn't even count them. Right?
Right. Why? Okay. Because it was the electors who chose, not the popular vote.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, I don't have it in front of me, but if you want to, one day we can actually go through, like maybe next year, we can go through the full history of how the Electoral College evolved to where every state allowed the people to choose their electors.
I'd like to see that sometime.
Yeah. And now I sent you the links because this is all, folks, this is all available on Wikipedia. So,
wow.
Yeah, I mean, and I know Wikipedia is not the most academic source, but when it comes to historical documents, I mean, all they're doing is they're showing you how it went. It's not like they had a dog in the fight to take it one way or the other, because bottom line, if they were trying to take it towards a popular vote, they would change that information so it didn't look like we were the ones choosing the electors. Because today, we're not the ones choosing the electors. The party chooses the electors. You don't see the elector's name on the ballot. You're throwing who you like. In other words, supposedly, in a primary, we're down-selecting. So when we go through this, you show me where the people are to down-select who the president is and create a ticket and have a party primary to do that. Because that's how we're doing it today, right? So it ought to be in here. But we're only through the first two lines of a very long paragraph. So, okay, so let's go to the next stanza. And let me see here. Where's the next semicolon? It's all the way down to where you see that big dash. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The seventh line down. So go ahead and read this next one and see how many different segments there might be in this one next stanza or this next clause. Go ahead.
Okay, so we're in Article...
The 12th Amendment.
Seventh line down, starting with...
No. We're starting with the next word after what you read. So
okay.
The third line, but you're just going to the next semicolon. Okay.
They shall name in their ballots the person voted for as president, and in distinct ballots, the person voted for as vice president. They shall make distinct lists of all persons voted for as president and of all persons voted for as a vice president, and of the number of votes for each, which lists they shall sign and certify and transmit, sealed to the seat of government of the United States, directed to the president of the Senate.
Okay, so that's the next step after what? After the electors are to vote, this actually gives them the details of how to vote. Mm-hmm. So what do they do? How are they voting?
Okay, well, they're voting by ballot for president.
Actually, but they're voting by name. So in other words, they write the name in their ballot, the person voted for as president. In other words, George Washington for president. And then on a separate and distinct ballot, they're going to write a different name who they're voting for as vice president, such as Thomas Jefferson.
Thomas Jefferson for vice president.
Or John Adams, right, correct. Go ahead.
Okay.
And so, to keep going, and they shall make distinct lists. So in other words, you know, they come together. So you got to remember that at this point, we have chosen the electors, and now they've met in their respective states. They're meeting at the state capitol. So now as they meet, they're voting, and they're writing on two separate ballots who they voted for here and who they voted for vice president. And then they shall make a distinct list of all persons voted for as president and all persons voted for as vice president. So they're having two distinct lists. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then which list they shall sign. It says lists. They make mm-hmm. two lists, a list for president and a list for vice president, and then they shall sign and certify and transmit sealed to Washington, D.C. of the United States, directed to the president of the Senate, okay?
Okay.
So what changed?
Well, let's see.
Now, we got a minute and a half, but if you really look at what they were supposed to do before, they actually wrote the name for two people, right? Mm-hmm. And at least one shall be an inhabitant, and at least one shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves, and they shall make a list of persons voted for and of the number of votes for each. So in other words, they basically create a single list, and they basically say, okay, Washington showed up on, you know, this many times, and this person showed up this many times. And what they did was they said, okay, the person who got the most votes was president, and the person who got the second amount of votes was vice president.
Correct. That's how they used to do it.
That's how they used to do it. But in this now, they actually say you have to vote and identify that this person is for president and that this person is for vice president. They want to segregate to make sure that maybe you wanted Washington for vice president so his vote wouldn't then count as president. What we're doing today is absolutely, in the primaries, absolutely wrong. Mm-hmm. So, okay. All right. I just wanted to make sure that we were looking at how they, you know, did this, and so they just created a single list of who got how many votes instead of having two separate lists. Okay.
Right. Now they have two separate lists.
Okay, now they have two separate lists. So what's the next step?
Okay.
Okay.
The person having the greatest number of votes for president.
No.
Yeah. Okay, what did I miss?
The 12th Amendment. No, so we just ran out of time. So we'll bring up where to go from here. And when we come back, folks, because we're bouncing back and forth between the second article, I can understand how it's confusing. So please be patient with me. And I really appreciate Paul's patience. So we'll be right back after this promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so in the 12th Amendment, it ends with directed to, so in other words, transmitted, sealed to the seat of government of the United States, directed to the President of the Senate. And then the 12th Amendment goes on and says the President of the Senate. So now it actually gets into a perfunctionary process, or I should say an administrative process that wasn't in the help me out here, Article 2.
Okay.
Okay?
Right.
All right. So go ahead.
So the President of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives, open all the certificates, and the votes shall then be counted.
Okay. And keep going.
Okay. The person having the greatest number of votes for president shall be the president, if such number be a majority of the whole number of electors appointed. If no person has such majority, then from the persons having the highest numbers not exceeding 3 on the list of those voted for as president, the House of Representatives shall choose immediately by ballot the president.
Okay. So there we go.
They take the top 3 names.
Well, let's just say that you go through the voting and they open all the certificates and the votes shall be counted. And then the person having the greatest number of votes for president shall be the president if such a number be a majority of the whole number of electors. In other words, all he needs is to have in the current election process or the elector process, you have to have 270 electors. That would be a basic majority of the Electoral College. So if the president or the votes come to a clear majority, then we have a president. But if not, and it says shall be the same number of majority of the whole of electors appointed, and if no person have such majority, then the persons having the highest numbers not exceeding 3 on the list. So in other words, you don't go down beyond 3. If you have 20 on the list, voting, you don't recount everything. You only take the top 2 or the top 3. Let's just say it's that close. You can only go down to 3. If it's really you only have 2 primary contenders and the third contender isn't even close,
right?
Then you don't consider them.
Right.
It says not to exceed 3. Okay? And then who votes for the president? When you take those 2 or 3 names, who then votes?
The House of Representatives votes for the president.
There you go. Hold on now. Okay. So it says now if the Electoral College cannot clearly create a president by a majority with one name, then they're done. Mm-hmm. There's no more involvement by the Electoral College regarding the president. The task then goes to the House of Representatives, where it is either a beauty contest between 2, no more than 3. And at that point, then the vote shall be taken, and So I'll you know what? I'll let you just go on from there.
Well, you know, there's a reason this is done in the House of Representatives.
Absolutely. And tell the people why.
Well, so the electors were representatives for the people.
There you go.
And if they don't come to the decision, then guess who else is the representatives for the people? It's the House.
The House, absolutely. And okay. So if your elector couldn't get the job done in the Electoral College, then it defaults to your representative. So, folks, right there, it proves that the person that really chooses the president is not your state legislature at all. It is to be the representatives of the people, mm-hmm. not the representatives of the party, or not the representatives of the legislature. Or the representatives of the governor who may be overreaching the legislature, or the majority, the Speaker of the House of your state. The people. There's nobody else that can be involved. No other entity is involved in the choosing of the president other than your representative, either the elector or your representative in the House of Representatives. Okay, so... Now you can go ahead and reread that. But in choosing, go ahead.
Okay. But in choosing the president, the vote shall be taken by states, the representation from each state having one vote. A quorum for this.
Okay, hold on. That was a semicolon.
Yeah,
okay, so
there.
What does that mean? So the House of Representatives shall go into chambers and they're going to vote. It doesn't say they're going to go into chambers, but that's what they do. They'll leave the open area of the rotunda and go into where the House of Representatives meets, where they both have their own chambers. And technically, that's right there where I think the House of Representatives is in the same rotunda, right?
Okay.
The Senate has their own chambers.
Sure. Right.
Which means that what's going to happen simultaneously is if you didn't get a president, there's a good chance you probably didn't get a vice president either. But that doesn't mean necessarily that's the case, but likelihood. But so they'll stay in chambers and the Senate may actually leave. Who knows? But bottom line, at that point, the states will have to then coalesce together. And they'll all have to basically do a hand count. Oh, you're for who, you're for who, you're for who, you're for who. They will create a list, and they will basically say, okay, it's unanimous, or the majority goes to this person, and the state gets one vote, which person for president. That's mm-hmm. it. So in other words, there's not going to be 400 some odd votes cast. There are 50 votes cast.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. A quorum for this purpose shall consist of a member or members from 2/3 of the states, and a majority of all the states shall be necessary to a choice.
So what does that mean?
It means that each state there needs to be a quorum, okay, a vote shall be taken in states' representation. Okay. A quorum for this purpose shall consist of a member or members from 2/3 of the states. So 2/3 of the states.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
No, so they're talking about the quorum of the state itself in the state of representatives.
So
in other words, you have to have, before you can, so hold on here. Before you can actually choose the president, you have to have quorum in each of the states.
Okay.
So, in other words, if you have two representatives and only one of them's present at the time, can that state vote for the president?
Well, it's not a majority.
It's not 2/3 of the state. Right. And so, in other words, you have to have at least a majority of your state present to be able to cast your vote. So, in other words, the election of the president waits until your deadbeat representatives show up to actually do their job in choosing the president. So, folks, there's a reason why there was the seating of the president wasn't until May or March, mid-March, if I remember correctly.
For sure. That's because they didn't have the type of transportation we had.
That's correct. And the winter was kind of tough to travel. So, you know, they, you know, did their election usually in the fall and or sometimes in the winter. But nevertheless, they would then, you know, force these guys to meet so that they could then choose the president. And this is usually during the working session of both Congress when the president gets seated. Mm-hmm. Okay, so anyway, so, you know, they may have to wait a day or two if the Electoral College fails for the chamber to actually vote. It doesn't happen immediately. Okay, so go ahead. Okay. It could happen immediately if quorum was met.
Okay.
Okay.
And a majority of all states should be necessary for a choice. And if the House of Representatives shall not choose a president whenever the right of choice shall devolve upon them, before the 4th day of March next following, then the vice president shall act as president.
Right. So how many shots at choosing the president is there?
Okay, there's one shot by the Electoral College,
uh-huh.
And there's one shot by the House of Representatives.
Right.
Actually, the people vote for their electors. The Electoral College has a shot. And then the House of Representatives has a shot. Looks like everyone's got one shot. Okay. Now, what's confusing to me, GR,
uh-huh.
is that what vice president shall act as president? You see what I'm saying? In uh-huh. other words, the House is in this chamber voting for president. The Senate is in this chamber. We'll get to that. Selecting the vice president. Okay? So my guess is that the Senate has chosen the vice president, and if the electors don't get it and the House doesn't get it, then the vice president becomes the president.
Yes.
Until a president can be chosen.
Oh, uh-huh. Okay. So
that's what it sounds like.
Yeah, so we now need to get into the vice president.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. So the person having the greatest number of votes as a vice president shall be the vice president. Okay. If such a number be a majority of the whole number of electors appointed, and if no person have a majority, then from the two highest numbers on the list, the Senate shall choose the vice president. Okay. This isn't by states. A quorum for the purpose shall consist of 2/3 of the whole number of senators.
Right.
And a majority of the whole number shall be necessary to a choice.
Right.
Okay.
So, in other words, each senator gets one vote to choose the vice president. So, however many senators there are, that's how many votes will be cast. They require a quorum of 2/3 of the body of the Senate. So, with 100 today, that means that they have to have at least 67. To actually have quorum, and then they have to come up with 51 votes for the vice president.
The other thing about this is it makes sense because the vice president is actually president of the Senate.
Yes.
Right? So yep. It makes sense that this would be broken down this way.
Right.
So here, I think there's one more sentence here, right?
Uh-huh.
This one's important.
Yeah.
But no person constitutionally ineligible to the office of president shall be eligible to the office of vice president of the United States.
Right, right. Because, there's nothing in Article 2 that identifies the qualifications of the vice president. The focus in Article 2 was that of the president.
Mm-hmm.
And so they didn't. So they felt it needed to be stated here that no vice president can be vice president if they don't meet the qualifications as the president.
Correct.
Right.
Okay. And that was. And apparently that wasn't. I guess that wasn't clear in the original Constitution. Correct.
Correct. So.
Okay.
So. One of the things that, you know, kind of changed this whole process, if I remember correctly, and you got to look at two, because at the very end of two, It basically says, now let me see here, was there another amendment? I think there was another amendment that amends the president. And is it the 20th Amendment? Let me see here. Proposed the term of the president, vice president shall end at the noon. Yes. And so there, the 20th and the 25th amendments actually have a little play on top of the 12th and Article 2. And okay. So this is where you can actually go through the pecking order of who's going to fill the office of the president if both the president and the vice president die. And I think the 25th Amendment, or hold it, is the 24th? Yeah. The 20th was, it came forward because FDR's health. Okay. And then when we look at the 21st Amendment, which was the basically the ending of prohibition. The 22nd Amendment, which was in 47, ratified in 51, this is where it says that no president more than twice can become president after two terms. So the two terms in 22. So when we look at it, you know, how many amendments do we have out of the 28 that affect and are involving the office of the president?
Well, there's 1, 2, 3 at least.
Correct. So right, there is the 12th.
Right.
There is the 20th.
Right.
There is the 22nd and the 25th. Four.
Right.
So there are four. So folks, that's basically 25%. That's one-fourth, right? One-fourth of all the amendments have to deal with the office of the president, the terms and the election, that all of that. So the framers created a very complex system, not a system that would be done by the simplicity of democracy or by the simplicity of what the parties want to give us. The only way, now these amendments speak to the process of what it takes to change or to alter how these amendments and the language of the Constitution can be executed. And how is it that we're executing the choosing of the president that it does not align whatsoever with any of this language in the Constitution?
How is it? That's a good question.
Because the parties have basically told everybody in government from the state up to the federal, this is how we do it. Mm-hmm. And the nice thing about it is because we do it this way, you have more power. Because as the party, we can ignore the Constitution and create compromises and grant ourselves whatever we need. I know I sent off, and I already got feedback. As a matter of fact, my phone rang that you didn't know because I have it silenced. Okay. But my phone rang from Wyoming, and I sent out, it's not a shot across the bow, but I kind of explained because, you know, Wyoming is a hotbed for patriotism. I mean, there's patriotism, and the unique thing, and I'm just going to give you, you know, and this may offend some Wyomingites, and that's not my intent, but the cowboy state is literally, you know, probably one of the most patriotic states out there. And I say that because they've consistently always ranked as, you know, highly Republican because the people do care about, you know, protecting their rights, you know, and they're huge on really individual rights and individual sovereignty because they were the first state that mandated or actually allowed women to vote. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were very, if you want to call it, classic liberal defenders of classic liberalism. And so the reason why, you know, GR is going down this path is I sent out an email because I think 2 weeks ago, or at least on my Feedback Friday, I talked about the difference between conservatives and constitutionalists and the danger of continuing to vote for conservatives. And see, the real problem is that in Wyoming, it is a conservative state. It's not a constitutional state.
Okay.
And that right there, you know, may have been the poke in the eye that probably caused that phone call, because I sent that out, you know, this weekend. And what I basically said is, a conservative is a person that protects your right to bear arms, but doesn't protect the Second Amendment. Because there's a big difference between you being able to have a gun and you actually going out and enforcing the laws, and you being the, you know, an active part of the militia, and that the militia being an active part of the education system, or I should say the education system being an integral part of the militia, and so forth and so on. I mean, when we really look at what it takes to honor and to live up to the Second Amendment, though, these conservatives are falling flat on their face.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, they're protecting your right to have a gun, but they have basically turned their back on the militia completely.
Correct. Completely.
And so it's the same thing with medical freedom. Oh, well, we don't want you to have mandates, but, you know, we're okay with Medicare and money coming in. I mean, if you look at how these guys ride these issues, they make it seem like they're defenders of the conservative values, but they're nowhere close to defending the Constitution. And so what this means, folks, is that when you have a conservative in office, this means that they're only opposing the progressives on social issues. They are actually working with the progressives on violating the Constitution, and they support that. A constitutionalist, on the other hand, does not support compromising the Constitution, actually demands compliance, and wants to hold every person in the chamber that is compromising and violating that Constitution, then they need to be removed because they're violating their oath of office. That's what a constitutionalist would do. So let me ask you this. How many constitutionalists do we have in office in any state?
I'm sorry, GR. I don't know that we have any.
We don't.
I mean,
but you know what? We've got guys that are starting to get it. We've got guys and gals in office that are starting to get it, folks. We need to help them. This movement of the full compliance and demanding full compliance is the only way the epiphany will start to occur. And I tell you that it can start easily at your county. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm sorry for going down this little rat hole, but I'm just looking at the time, and we have three 13th amendments that we need to go through. We just wrapped up the 12th, and the evidence that's come out of the 12th amendment just proves how we have been, I'll just say, they've pulled the wool over our eyes, and they're beating us senseless, folks. They're beating us senseless because the compromise due to the party is up for I should say the Constitution is up for compromise because of the party.
Right.
Forgive me. I think my dyslexia is only getting worse. Because people are pointing out, well, no, you said this. And I go, yeah, but I meant to say that. Anyway.
Okay.
Any other... any other points or things you want to bring up that might be fruitful or important before we start going into the 13th amendments?
So I was doing kind of a search to discover when we started counting. I've discovered the 1824 election, for some reason, they started counting popular votes. The Library of Congress showed the only electoral college votes up to 1820. So I thought that was interesting.
So if are you looking at Wikipedia?
I did a search, and I was looking at the Library of Congress.
Okay, so the Library of Congress is projecting information. So if you go to before you know, point out, because the Library of Congress will point you to the annotated Constitution. Do you believe that?
Oh.
Do you believe the Library of Congress is actually being honest and, you know, giving you the truth, the ground truth of really what happened? What they're doing is they're editorializing. They're not showing you facts and documents.
The Library of Congress?
That's correct. Right? I mean, go look at the annotated Constitution. What they're showing you is how they interpret the Constitution, how the judges have interpreted it. It's the same thing with, I mean, many of the things that we're looking at. If you actually go through, because you actually have to have the state records. You have to have the state records to look at the Electoral College.
Yes, but they were counted in the Congress, so they would see that, right?
So they only count what the Electoral College gave them. How did they obtain okay. So what you're saying is that the electors by the 1820s, which is what I was saying, in the early 1800s, it became a unanimous process that we the people chose our electors.
Correct.
That's okay, right. But you're calling it a popular vote, and it's not. A popular vote is the voting for the president by the people.
What I meant was okay. to say that I saw that they were only using electors. What I said that in what the Library of Congress did is they started reporting what the popular vote was. Before that, they didn't. That's what I was saying. Okay, they show the electors. But in 1824, the Library of Congress is showing the popular vote. And I thought that was interesting. I hadn't gone beyond 1824 to see what they did for each beyond that, which is very strange.
Yes, okay. So the fact of the matter is, folks, is that we the people, for the longest time, never voted for president. The president's name was never on the ballot. We voted for the electors, and the electors chose both the president and the vice president. And it maintained that all the way into the presidential election of Lincoln. How do I know this? Because the party would never have allowed a Democrat and a Republican to split the administration. And that's what happened. That's why the parties stepped in and said, we'll never allow this perversion to occur again.
But the Constitution allows it.
Absolutely. So in other words, the party stepped outside. They compromised on what they were going to do and ignored the Constitution, just like they compromise on, well, we're going to allow you to keep guns. But folks, over time, that compromise will go away. And folks, we've ran out of time over time. So, Paul, we'll have you back tomorrow. I really appreciate your time. And folks, I hope you're really starting to see one of the biggest problems we have is the party. This is why we have a process of actually eradicating the party, and it's all about constitutional compliance. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.